I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by David Walker of the Daily Mirror and tactical analyst Adrian Clark. Welcome to the Killing Zone, otherwise known as the Autumn International Break. This is the time when chairmen tend to lose patience and managers run for cover. We'll look at the coming men like Sean Dyche and Marco Silva. But first, David, who's got most to fear?
Well, I think at the moment the undercurrent, the negativity around the two clubs is probably West Ham with Slaven Bilic, and looking at this morning's papers, Ronald Koeman at Everton. I've got to say, I think for both of them, I think it'd be wrong to sack them at the moment, but I think for both of them, there's a positive in that they are working for boards of directors that have not shown themselves to be trigger happy in the past. I think there is an element to Everton that is out there and unknown, which is the Mashiri funding. He's new to that Everton boardroom, he and his advisors. You wonder if that could change the normal Bill Kenwright, we're going to back our man. I've got to say, looking at the Everton thing, there was the whole experiment of recruiting Koeman, of bringing Steve Walsh in. They've had a very poor, frustrating, disappointing start, which is made worse by the expectations around the club. But I think to tear it up after seven league games and be sacking the manager and or the director of football would be an act of madness. And I've got to say, Mike, it's in the DNA of Everton, where they learned the lesson once before, where Howard Kendall was nearly sacked first time round and a few weeks later set off and they created the most brilliant, successful era of their modern times.
Doesn't feel like Everton are on the verge of that, though, does it? I mean, seven games into this season, but he was there last season. So he's had plenty of time to mould Everton into the kind of team he wants. When I watch Everton, I don't know what they are. I don't know what I'm going to see. I don't know which 11 I'm going to see from one game to the next. And that's part of the problem. He's panicking. Ronald Koeman is panicking with his team selection at the moment. We're seeing different players pop up each week. He's even reverted to Nias, a player he ostracised not so long ago. Took away his first team locker. So I just wonder about his man management. There weren't too many tears shed at St Mary's when he left. I know that. Good record at Southampton. On the face of it, did a terrific job. But the people there that I've spoken to weren't that fond of him.
And he's made a big call in basically after six, seven games, dropping Wayne Rooney.
Yeah, I think he always said from the start that Rooney could be around the team. There was no guarantee of Wayne Rooney playing every game, and it suggested he told Wayne Rooney that. I mean, the biggest fact is, and I don't know who you say, it was Bill Kenwright, it's Mashiri, it's Steve Walsh, you know, it's Ronald Koeman. The fact is, they shouldn't have sanctioned Romelu Lukaku's exit, albeit for £75 million, and albeit Lukaku wanted to go. That should not have been sanctioned without his replacement in the building. And it doesn't matter which team you're looking at in the Premier League now, and you can look in recent years. For instance, Swansea are struggling for goals now. When they first got Wilfried Boney in, and he got a load of goals from, guess what? Teams with strikers who give you 15, 20 goals a season go up the league. Everton are lacking a 20-goal striker and should have dealt with that in the summer. So it's OK now saying, we thought we had Giroud. You know, there was a deal there. We were convinced it was going to be. They didn't get Giroud. They didn't get anybody. And that's the big problem.
And recruitment, you know, we say it often enough, don't we, Adrian, is an absolute key. Now, if you look at the recruitment they made over the summer, you've got basically about four or five players who love to play in a number 10 role. Yeah. They've got too many
of one particular type of player.
Of course they are. Well, they should. Once they went for the first number 10, which was Davy Klasser, they really probably should then have called off their pursuit of Wayne Rooney, called off their pursuit of Gylfi Sigurdsson. But they didn't want to do that because they was two big names, two names that the fans would love to get on board. But for purely tactical reasons and the makeup and the balance of Koeman's squad, there was no need. It was a completely, especially when you've got Ross Barkley, who ended up not going anywhere. They were completely unnecessary signings. And I think in the case of Sigurdsson, I would have taken him over Klasser.
I think that was the first one, to be honest, though. I think the list.
But they didn't get Sigurdsson until the end.
But the time, what I'm saying is, when they've looked at their wish list, there had to be a replacement for Lukaku of some sort, and they thought but they didn't. That is the biggest single fault. Then you're looking at the other bits. It was Sigurdsson was ahead of anybody. Klasson, they always said, would not be guaranteed first team. And let's be honest, the Wayne Rooney return is very much boardroom driven in the sense of Bill promised he would bring the son home, and he did it.
Massively predictable. Yeah. You can have all the midfielders in the world. You can have glorious creative players, but if you haven't got a quality striker up top, someone that can stretch opponents and strike fear into them, you're not going to score many goals.
But they've also got experienced players at the back who are making mistakes.
Yeah, Ashley Williams is having a nightmare, isn't he? He's having a shocker of a start to the season. But again, though, what's Koeman want? Is it a back three? Is it a back four? He chops and changes from one week to the next. It feels like he's accommodating Phil Jagielka, senior player in that dressing room. Maybe he doesn't want to upset him. Mason Holgate, he brought him in. Bit of a fanfare, next big thing. Boom, he's out. I just feel that he's not a great man manager. I think he's a good tactician. Mm. He's clearly a talented coach, but he's not a complete coach by any stretch of the imagination. And I can see a parting of the ways in the next month or two. I really can.
Yeah, and it was no coincidence we're having this discussion after Sean Dyche has basically gone there and said to him, the world, indirectly, of course, look at me, Mum.
By the way, Sean Dyche has been able to get on with his job there, done really well, sold a couple of, like, losing King to Everton at £25 million. He's worked, bedded people in. And certainly, I mean, they're away results. Everybody says about the smaller teams, you've got to get your home wins.
Eight points out of those four games.
Absolutely. It's been brilliant. Done a great job.
Why he's a great manager or a really promising manager, let's not label him great just yet, but he's really good at what he does. It's clarity. When you watch Burnley, every player knows what their job is, inside out, from 1 to 11. It doesn't matter if you've got injuries because his backups are bought or brought in and they're coached to play that specific role, and they do it really well. They've got limitations, Burnley. They're not going to finish in the top six. But in terms of how he coaches, how he manages, he's superb.
Well, I think if you look at, say, Tarkowski, who's gone in there, he was a classic case in point that if any other club had sold a player of keen stature, there would have been a stampede into the market. Mm. But Dyche knew what he had in reserve and has coached him brilliantly on the training ground.
I've got to tell you, I remember seeing Tarkowski. James Tarkowski was a young lad playing for Oldham Athletic who were facing financial issues, and he was a really gifted young lad. And I raised it with a Premier League club. I was chatting to the manager one day. I said, have you seen this boy Tarkowski at Oldham? He said, yeah, but the intriguing thing is he's a Mancunian. United and City had looked at him. He'd been floating around. And he'd just fallen through that, and he rocks up at Oldham. And then it becomes this, well, how can he be a really outstanding prospect if he's playing for Oldham? And almost Burnley get him by default because of this. And, OK, money's paid, but it's nothing sensational. It's this real nugget that they found, they've burnished. And let's be honest, he wasn't a regular at Burnley until Michael Keane's gone.
He does the job.
So I think that is the whole point of scouting and recruitment in your football club, wherever you are, be it top of the Premier League or in League Two, that you have got an awareness of that sort of player who's knocking around.
Mm. One club who've had, let's say, and be kind and say, a patchy recruitment record is West Ham.
Right, yeah.
Slaven Bilic has got this wonderful knack of winning when he needs to most.
Yes, doesn't he? Yeah. Keeps digging these results out when he needs them, Slaven Bilic. Look, I like Slaven Bilic because I've seen him produce some real tactical masterclasses in the early spell of his West Ham reign. He's just lost his mojo. I don't know what's happened to him.
Seems a bit fearful to me.
He really does. He's lost a bit of fire. You used to see him jumping around in that technical area a bit more. But it wasn't just that. He sent his teams out with clear game plans, implemented properly. And they're just wishy-washy now, West Ham, and quite dull to watch. Got a lot of talent there, clearly. But no, he's on the edge, no doubt about that. I think I read a report today that they're going to stick with Slaven Bilic. And I've read this same report quite a few times already. Mm. Under no circumstances will West Ham...
But you also, in between that, read that he's actually under pressure. Well, now, where's that coming from?
Because it's obvious. No Premier League manager is safe. Lose three or four on the bounce, Bilic is gone. End of story. So it's nonsensical to say that he is there for the season. It really is.
No, and I think you're right. The results dictate it all. But there was a quote a couple of weeks ago by Ronald Koeman who said, after a particularly bad night, we've got the next four games at home. We win those four home games and everything will calm down going into the international break. And you thought, Ronald, you're spot on, but now you're going to have to deliver four wins. Now, they win the first two, and you're thinking, OK, he's getting there. Then guess what? A Cypriot team, Apollon Limassol, come and get a 2-2 draw with the last with 10 men, and then you lose at home to Burnley. So what your own target, you fail to deliver on, and that's why you end up under pressure.
Mm. One person who's really bedded in very quickly into his new job is Marco Silva at Watford.
Yeah,
you know, we poo-pooed him a bit. Wrongly, when he first came into the Premier League. His reputation actually soared despite relegation.
Yeah, it did.
And so that was, you know, a few whispers behind the back of the hands thinking, well, why is that? Yeah. But actually, he's proving himself.
He's good, yeah. Look, he knows what he's doing, clearly. I like the recruitment that he's made at Watford, actually. He's made them more entertaining, so the fans like him. They're very attractive to watch now. Richarlison, I think, is a top signing. Really clever, astute buy. Gives them balance down that left-hand side, which they really missed last year. And Doucouré, he's getting a tune out of Doucouré, who was kind of a non-entity at times when he first joined.
Well, he disappeared without trace.
He was nowhere. He couldn't get in the team for a start. And then when he did play, you didn't really notice him. Now, he's the rock of which Watford are being built around. He's a good coach. He improves players.
And I think the other thing has been, and I take my hat off to him on this, he's been decisive there. They were very quickly making signings while others, and there was one or two of the London clubs supposedly, and the players were signing for Watford. Yeah. You go, oh, that. But he actually went, right, hey, if we're going to do this, these are the players we want, let's get them signed. And he's delivering on it.
And the one trait that stands out above any other with Watford and the new players have brought in is pace. It's all about speed. And he's a modern coach. He understands the needs of a modern, vibrant team. And he knows that Watford haven't got the most gifted players in the Premier League. But if he can gather some of the quickest, it will help them both, you know, in attacking capacity and at the back. It'll make them less vulnerable. So I think he is one of the smartest coaches in the Premier League, Marco Silva.
Mm. And, you know, I've been critical of the Pozzos in the past because I think they've changed the identity of the club. In the transfer market, they know their onions, don't they?
One all the things that we have traditionally said about stability, consistency, backing. I mean, they just tear it all up and rotate managers, and then the same.
I think Silva will get more than a season.
Well, let's hope. I would hope so, but the other
thing is, he might get poached.
I'm going to say, let's see what happens, because if he starts getting them into the Europa League, I'll bet there'll be a. Do you want to have another job? And he's got no great commitment to be at Watford after that. So that would be out of a positive. All I'm saying is...
Silver to Everton. Can we say it? I could.
Yeah. A lot of the positives that you would see from stability, consistency, give the guy a chance, Watford appear to tear those things up. Their recruitment, their knowledge of an international market has been superb, which clearly... I think a lot of it's down to the tentacles they've got out there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, as you know, we don't throw this show together. Well, we do, but hey, there's a theme emerging about recruitment.
Okay.
Let's look at Liverpool.
Yeah.
Their summer has been terrible in the transfer market.
Well, they signed Mo Salah. He's been good. The neglect of the back four. The neglect of the back four is criminal, really, from Liverpool's point of view. The head of recruitment there. He's got to be skating on thin ice, I would have thought, because...
Michael Edwards, stats man, very close to the Boston owners, can do no wrong, apparently.
Well, he has done wrong because he hasn't identified a central defender or two.
Well, he did, didn't he? Hang on. He did.
Well, look, we all identified Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, but he did. And they wrongly did a lot of things that most clubs do, as in tapping the player up.
And they mucked up.
And van Dijk led them to believe, whatever it takes, I will do to get you. So they did. They knew the weakness. But you're right. The issue is, if you're not going to get number one target, who is number two target? Because you still need him. If he's
what I don't understand with Klopp, and I like Klopp, but what I don't understand, he keeps saying, yeah, well, you know, we're in the mix, we're title contenders, and going forward, great. But they're clearly not title contenders, because you can't win the league with Lovren and Matip or Lovren and Clavin at the back. You can't win the league with Moreno as your left back. Mm. You can't even win the league with Mignolet. I'm sorry, he's not quite good enough. How he didn't see that and go scream for upgrades, I find amazing.
He did with Mignolet in the sense of he told Carrius, when Carrius arrived, it was in the belief he was going to be the Liverpool number one. Yeah. Now he's not up to the job either in the sense of what we would expect from that. So there is another example of your recruitment. That was Klopp's recommendation and call, let's go. The lad went in thinking, here I am. And he's not delivered.
What about them tactically? Yeah. You know, Johnny Northcroft, regular on the show, did a really good piece in Sunday Times at the weekend about the flaws, the sudden flaws in Liverpool's pressing game.
I think there's a myth that they press really hard at the pitch. It doesn't really happen that often. It's more in the middle third. And when they nail it, Liverpool, they did sort of against Arsenal. Arsenal were terrible on that day. When they nail it like they did last season in the big games, they are very, very effective at the pressing game. But no, I think with Liverpool, the problem they've got is that's it. What else do they do? They haven't got that other option. Klopp hasn't got a different system. It's 4-3-3, isn't it? Yeah. So that's it. Occasionally, they might switch to a back three. It's identifying the recurring themes, the problems of being caught themselves on the counter. When they push up high, they attack, boom, one pass splits the centre halves, who are seemingly never prepared or ready. I think what my big criticism of Klopp tactically is that, is he addressing the flaws? Is he coming up with an alternative when plan A doesn't work? And the answer to those questions on both scores is no.
Mm. Not. And do you think that we're now already, then they're not in the title race anymore, are they?
Do I? I think it's dangerous to try anybody off at the beginning of October because you don't know what can happen. And let's be honest, not too long ago, is it 2 years ago, we weren't at the beginning of October saying, do you know what, Mike, Leicester City are going to win the title. So there can be a freak season and something could happen. But you're right. And
one win in seven?
No, well, I was just going to say, I don't know if you saw it, but Rafa Benitez did an analysis of winning the league in England through his time working within the Premier League.
Right.
And he made the point that, in effect, the richest clubs should win it, as in the ones with the most available money and where you've had a period of time to get people into your team. And the challenge he had, whilst he won the Champions League in his first season at Liverpool, he finished second to Manchester United in his second, and they got a lot of points, Liverpool. But the point was, a Ferguson Manchester United club with an awful lot more money coming in from tickets and ability to spend saw off the title. They did it. Now, his point was, if you look now, we take it to now, you've got Manchester City, Manchester United and Chelsea can outspend any of the rest. So, realistically, I don't think Liverpool will win the league, no. And I think there is a reason why, because those three clubs, especially the two in Manchester this season, have been running away, that they will see it through. If those three screw it up and come out with crazy decisions, bad injuries, things start going wrong, that's when somebody could do, as we say, a Leicester. And maybe it's Liverpool, maybe it's Tottenham. But they're out, they're not in there at the moment.
I agree with the idea. Yeah, I think no chance for the reasons I outlined earlier, just defensively. But Leicester won the title because they were disciplined and organised and very, very hard to beat. Liverpool right now, not hard to beat. Mm.
What about the job that Rafa's doing, since you mentioned him, David?
Yeah.
What I find is he playing a waiting game there? Is he trying to see off Mike Ashley?
I don't know. There was the hedge fund manager, wasn't there?
Amanda Staveley. Yeah.
Staveley was there.
She's just got the £28 billion to spend.
No, I saw that. That will excite Newcastle fans. I don't know. Look, I just think Rafa's getting on with his job. I mean, well, Rafa won't just get on with his job ever because he loves to get involved with the politics, doesn't he? But when if you judge him as a coach, as a manager, a match play manager, he's as good as they come, isn't he? I mean, he should really be a better team, not a better club, because it's a great club, Newcastle. Yeah. He should have a better set of players to work with. I think when I said at the start of this season, I said, when I look at that Newcastle squad, it screams bottom five, bottom six to me. So anything above that, I think he's really overachieving. So far, definitely so good for Rafa. Mm.
On the field, Rafa's got a great eye for detail and preparing his team. Off it, Rafa's got a great nose for the DNA of your club, be it Liverpool, be it Newcastle now. He buys into what the people want and understands the communication, and he's brilliant at it. He gets it. Now, if you were watching that yesterday and you see the game, it's fantastic. St James's Park is one of the great stadiums. You get that packed. And the fact is, the Geordie faithful are screaming with delight when they're winning throw-ins and a tackle goes in. You know, but and I'm saying this as a commendation. Yeah. They are so passionately with it. Yeah. And, we've talked about the cathedrals of where they just sit there, in the expensive seats, make it happen. And why is it not like I've seen at a weekend on the action replay? Geordies know football, know where their team is, and Rafa can communicate with the Geordie nation. He gets it.
And because of that intrinsic passion for the game and the club, surely that is a brilliant club to take over.
Absolutely right. The fact is, and this was identified back around, 20 years ago in the late 90s, Freddie Shepherd, the whole family were in there, and Alex Ferguson made the point, the extension of St James's Park, the club you could see really kicking on to be one of the superpowers of English football was Newcastle United. And they didn't do it. They nearly got there and they were close to it, but they didn't make it and they ended up going into decline. Now, the weird thing is, Mike, the Geordie nation still adore that team. That is their cathedral that they'll go to, and they will give a backing and a noise level in there that's hard to match at any other ground in England. But the fact is, Rafa's got them in a way that no manager's had since Kevin Keegan.
Yeah, I agree.
I've been really impressed with Jamal Lascelles there.
Yeah.
Now, he had a stage earlier in the season when he was out the side, but the maturity and the natural leadership style.
Well, he's old school.
Yeah.
He's built like centre-half used to be built.
And
like.
He also doesn't mind calling out his teammates.
No, that was really interesting. Was it a year ago, a year or two ago, when he was really critical of his teammates? And then Rafa made him captain again. Mm. Rafa, clever man, thinks this guy is someone the fans can relate to as a player, as a person, and he named him the captain. Yeah, I think he's got a really bright future, Jamal Lascelles. I think in the long term, Newcastle, with the current squad, have got a real ceiling. Mm-hmm. That ceiling's probably not much far above mid-table, to be perfectly honest. I watched them at Huddersfield and they were pretty poor. But they did the basics right, don't they, under Rafa? They don't gift you too many games. And I'm a big fan of his. And I'll say it again, he should really be managing. He should be working with a better group of players.
Mm. Would that include Jonjo Shelvey? Do you think is he worth persevering with?
Yeah, without a doubt. But there is a character, it's a character flaw that's in there. The kid's got ability, but he has to show he has conquered that. I mean, there's plenty of players down the years, including a Frenchman who rocked up at Leeds and then Man United, who had shown in the previous, in his previous career, this, impossible attitude to changing his view on referees, teammates, and just kept getting sent off and doing crazy things. Some of the Shelvey stuff you look at, I think, when will you learn? If he was to learn, I'm not elevating him into he could be as good as Cantona. He could be an outstanding Premier League footballer and a cornerstone for Newcastle if he just gets his head around, I'm a footballer.
I think the if's too much.
Okay, well.
Yeah, no, I think he probably won't be a Premier League player much longer. And I know that sounds really harsh. So I love watching him play. I think he's got that eye for a pass is brilliant. But he's not a kid anymore. And it's time and time again, he keeps making the same mistakes, keeps having this little peaks of form and then going off the radar for a month or two. I just don't know if he's got it up there inside his mind to be a top-level Premier League player. I hope I'm wrong because I like watching him. But I don't see a long-term future at the high level because of what goes on in his head.
Mm. Let's now look, David, at the significance of what will be one of the most significant games of the season. City winning at Chelsea, winning well at Chelsea. Mm. Let's look at the impact on Antonio Conte. Mm. Already gone on record about his love for Italy, I'll be back soon. Mm. Is this going to be his last season?
Yeah, I think it will be. But I think I think that was an incredibly important win for Manchester City within their sort of head-to-head battles with Chelsea in recent years. But more to the point, going into it, Chelsea's performance in Madrid against Atletico Madrid was absolutely superb. Let's be honest. Mm. Simeone has got a team there at Atletico Madrid that are normally so high intensity that they will swarm anybody and you will have huge problems. The fact being they don't lose at home until Chelsea go there. And for my mind, and epitomised by Eden Hazard, Chelsea were absolutely brilliant on that Wednesday night. Cut to the weekend, you're thinking, now this could be a really interesting game. And which Man City turn up? They've lost Aguero with the car crash in Amsterdam. You end up looking at that and Manchester City's response was brilliant. The quality of the game, what they did was superb. And you know what? We actually had the conversation last year on this very seat saying Guardiola has to get more movement from his full-backs or wing-backs. And you look at who had the most touches for Manchester City in Saturday's brilliant performance at Chelsea, and it was the two.
It was brilliant. Yeah. Why did Conte not pick the same team? Why did he go so defensive? I think that's the question he has to answer. I think that's the regret he'll have. Why did he pick Moses? He's at home. Mm. He went Rudiger. He got scared. He was scared of Manchester City. Why did he put Fabregas in the middle of the three in midfield as a deep guy with Conte and Bakayoko either side? I think he made a couple of big errors, really. I'm not saying he handed it on a plate to City, because City had to play superbly to beat them. But I think Conte went Italian. It sort of overcame him and he thought, I don't want to get beat here. And that played into City's hands. So let's give Guardiola credit. I mean, he's got them playing phenomenal football without sacrificing defence.
There's a case of the bite a bit here, isn't there? Because about this time last year, Conte changed Chelsea's structure, won the title with wing-backs.
Yeah.
City did the same to him, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got to say, Mike, I'm old enough to remember a few teams where they've gone 8, 10, 12 games, be it unbeaten or with 10 wins in that, and were hailing them as champions by October, November, and they ended up blowing it. So, you know, the one I really think is going to be an interesting collision, and I can't wait for Jose to start lobbing the verbal hand grenades, never mind any physical face-ups on it, is when it's City United. I do think it's going to emerge as the Battle of Manchester for winning the league. Yeah. But and Jose will not attempt. He won't have any doubts about saying, well, we're not going to have a game of football.
He's going to kill it, isn't he?
We'll do this.
But they're blowing everyone away. Yeah. What I find most remarkable about Manchester City's form at the moment is that they're doing all this with virtually a team full of attackers. I mean, where are the defensive-minded players in that team? And Stones and Otamendi and Fernandinho. That's it. It is they are overwhelming opponents with their brilliance. And I think he is an outstanding coach. I mean, he does improve players remarkably. And he's innovative, isn't he? He comes up with unusual things that throw teams. And at the moment, I think that's what's happening. It'd be interesting to see whether rival managers begin to work out a way of coping with City. What happens then? Knowing Guardiola's track record, he's probably got another plan up his sleeve.
Can I just tell you about what you asked about Chelsea as well?
Yeah.
Something struck me. When I saw the Conte quotes about Italy's my homeland, you know, I can see my, you know, I'll be returned one day, etc.
Good old-fashioned come and get me, please.
Absolutely. It's putting everybody on alert that, you know, the time may be right at a point. Do you know the other thing that struck me? If you look, that is entirely consistent with almost the coaching techniques and beliefs, the career plan of an awful lot of Italian coaches tend to be around 2 or 3 years. Mm. And they almost accept the club president as they have changing it then. And I know, you know, you say, well, he had 4 years of fire. you don't get the Arsene Wenger, you don't get the Alex Ferguson, you don't get what maybe Manchester
that's
City
why he didn't, that's why, that's did. That's why he didn't care about Ruben Loftus-Cheek. He didn't care about, you know, Izzy Brown. No interest, because he knows he's only going to be there 2 or 3 years. Ancelotti is a case in point. How many teams has he managed for 2 or 3 years?
Correct.
Could he go back to Chelsea, maybe?
Yeah. What about Arsenal?
What, Carlo Ancelotti? Well, there's not a vacancy, is there? So I don't know when there will be one, really, looking at it. I think he would be quite a popular choice, but is his reputation a bit tainted now? I don't know. He hasn't really done the business, has he, at Bayern Munich, Carlo Ancelotti? I've always been a real fan of his, not because he's a great tactician, but because his teams play really fast, attacking football. I've always really enjoyed watching Ancelotti teams. And I like him, because he's so chilled out, isn't he? He's got this kind of... Nothing seems to faze him, including the sack. Mm. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe that moment's passed for Arsenal. He's becoming more of a senior manager now, I think, Carlo Ancelotti. Yeah. I'd imagine Arsenal going for somebody younger post-Wenger.
I must admit, I did have a quiet chuckle when I saw him linked inevitably to West Ham.
Yeah, you're thinking, would Carlo Ancelotti want to join West Ham? Well, there is a moot point. I think working with a number of West Ham fans, they would love to see Carlo Ancelotti rock up there at some point, because they would see that.
Well, Rafa went to Newcastle, didn't he?
Indeed.
From Real Madrid, was it? Yeah, that was his previous job. It's not going to happen, though, is it?
I wouldn't thought so, no. I wouldn't have thought so. When we look at Guardiola, you know, let's face it, he did get some stick, didn't he?
Deservedly.
Underachiever and everything else. Yeah. Is this the season where he wins everyone over?
It feels that way. It's just early. It's a little bit too early to say. But last season, I think Guardiola had a pretty terrible campaign, really, in terms of underachieving with the talent he had. There were basic flaws that were not being fixed. But he's clearly worked incredibly hard with the players, obsessively so. And they just look so pumped up, so in tune with what he wants from them. They are overwhelming a lot of teams. I can see them smashing most of the Premier League by 4 and 5. It's just, will they be able to do that to Manchester United?
Do you know, Mark, I think that Manchester scene, and I'm old enough to remember it, but you think of the 60s or the late 60s, where you had the Malcolm Allison, Joe Mercer team, that really eclipsed Man United, certainly in domestic football, and went and won the league in 68 when United were the big rivals. You then ended up with the team that Roberto Mancini had when it went to the last day of the season, Man United at Sunderland, and guess what? City go and nail it with a great Aguero goal, etc. but it was brilliant for City fans that they could see that. I really think this is going to be a fantastic head-to-head season, but you know what? There's a huge difference. Back then, it was Malcolm Allison's coaching. A guy called Joe Lancaster was the athletics coach. He got in, he got them super fit, he got them to a different level. And it was United who had the best Lord Charlton Cavalier football approach. Now you're looking at it, this season, and for this Mourinho against Guardiola, City are going to be the Cavaliers and United are the Roundheads now. Mm. United are the efficient, we will deliver. Now, that changes it all. And you wonder what the outcome can be with that.
And you can't have a rounder head than Marouane Fellaini, can you? What he's doing in that team goes against all logic, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's a good player. Like, he delivered for Everton, didn't he? I've just never really got Fellaini and what he is. Is he, you know, is he a striker? Is he a 10? He does look better, I must say, in the deeper role, breaking forward when he picks and chooses the right times. No, he's been well coached by Mourinho. Fits in well in that Manchester United side, who, let's face it, will go direct. A lot of their play is built around knocking high balls into the box, especially from corners and free kicks, obviously. Jose Mourinho has always put quite a high stock on that. So, no, look, he's a typical Mourinho player. He's not a typical Man United player, but it's working for them at the moment. Yeah, I just think in those big games, you wouldn't back against Jose, I don't think, against Pep. I think he could just get the point he needs, potentially. They've just got to stick close enough to City United. And I think in the big duels, that's might be where it's
going. And the other thing is, Mike, whatever is said, and I'm sure it will be said nearer the time out, the history's gone, the Barca, Real Madrid, Rara. There is fundamentally a difference in approach and football attitude between Guardiola and beyond what you see the teams. I'm not sure they really say respect, probably not, like each other. There is a real desire to put one over. the other to prove the point that has been there for many, many years. This is right back to early Barcelona.
I'd rather see City win it. I want to watch teams playing the City way, playing the Guardiola way. No doubt about that. I'd love them to. Well, I wouldn't love them to win it because I want Arsenal to win it. But if they can't win it, I would much prefer City.
Yeah, but isn't might is right, they say, and that, I can see United steamrolling their way through the title.
Yeah, well, ultimately, they've still got the same defence. I mean, they've still got the same defenders, Company, Stones, Otamendi. They've still really only got Fernandinho as your holding midfielder. So when injuries bite, when this overwhelming domination of games dries up a little bit, are those guys capable of not making the errors that they were making last year? I think that's the big question mark. I would like City to win the league, but based on what I've seen so far, and I did tip City at the start of the season, based on what I've seen so far, I'd lean more towards United because they've got that solidity.
Mm. In a sort of a private fantasy world, a few...
I don't know if I want to share that. Okay.
in this private fantasy world that United fans inhabit,
yes,
they'd love to see Cristiano Ronaldo come back to Old Trafford. Now he's looking for $25 million a year from Real Madrid. If they don't give it to him, will that fantasy ever be fulfilled?
I don't think it will now. I think maybe in the last 2 years, and I say this because of the political things surrounding Man United and the marquee signing time, I just think where they've gone to with Lukaku, Pogba and what United have got, I'm not sure. And, you know, where they're going forward with the Rashfords and the Martials. Cristiano Ronaldo is without doubt, and he's there with Messi, obviously, but in that top two of players we've seen in the last 15 years. He's a brilliant footballer and he's very popular with Manchester United. And I'll tell you something about Ronaldo that probably people don't see when, you know, the viewers, etc. When Cristiano Ronaldo's away with Real Madrid or Portugal, if he sees any of the Manchester press guys there in a mix zone, he always comes over, remembers the old roots, where, hi, guys, do you need to speak to me? Can I help you? He's absolutely brilliant at remembering this and spotting faces and just going, yeah, can I help? Mm. Which a lot of people just think he's some flash, you know, and this...
Cristiano Ronaldo, media whore. Who would have thought it?
Cristiano Ronaldo spotting some of the boys that he's known for when he was...
No, I like that.
I just think that's a different insight we get into him. But you're saying specifically, can you see it now? I'm not sure I can see that. The other thing which I thought was interesting at the weekend, Matt, Danny Blind, Daly's dad... Danny Blind is on Dutch TV at the weekend. Now, he obviously has a link into the United dressing room with his son there. And Danny Blind delivers the observation, well, there are the untouchables at Manchester United. There are six players who know they will be in Jose's first team. And the rest of the team, the whole of the first team squad then, is fighting for the five other places. And you look at the way it's going, and obviously Pogba was one of the six and he's injured. So it opens up an extra place.
That's where it's been.
But... Yeah, but I think where Jose has been, he's always trying to make it. He's prepared to change anything, and he's, you know, he's dropped some big name players. Mm. But it gives you the view of what they've got there, and the tightness he's got on.
He had his untouchables at Chelsea, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the way he is. Yeah.
Some listeners and viewers questions. Okay. Adam Kearsey says, in our experience, which have been the top players with the most unfulfilled potential? I'll kick it off if you like.
Yeah.
From my point of view, it would be Ravel Morrison.
Yeah.
Supremely gifted player, hugely troubled background. He finds himself playing in Mexico when he really should be playing still for Manchester United. Yeah. I think that sums
it
up.
I spoke to Giggsy a few years ago and I said, who are the kids coming through? And he was raving about Morrison. I think he was only 14 or 15 at the time. He said, this kid's magic. But he did say then, he said, but it comes from a difficult background, you know, that might be the problem. It's hard. There have been so many I've seen down the years, so many amazing talents that never quite made it. Probably from recent times, I remember Nick Powell when he was at Crewe Alexandra. All the scouts, I remember I was at the Roots Hall for a South End game and all the scouts were there, all of them, all the big guns, and they were all there to watch him, and he was brilliant. And I came away that night thinking, this is a kid, he's going to play for England. And his attitude isn't right. Clearly, he's fallen off the wagon. I think he's at Wigan now, doing all right for Wigan. But he's never going to make it to the elite level now. That moment's passed. So you, talent alone is never, ever enough. I would say the one player at Arsenal, and it's a different case, is Jack Wilshere. By this stage of the career, having watched Jack when he was a teenager, I expected him to be Gazza-esque by now. I expected him to be England's main man, running matches, being the dominator for the Gunners. And it just hasn't worked out that way, because mainly because of injuries. So, yeah, I hope that his talent eventually gets fulfilled.
Yeah, I've got one as a young emerging player, and I look back and I'm haunted by the thought of, was it four, five or maybe six different countries, including England, putting out the old cloak of welcome, come and play for us, the most gifted player in Europe, the world, whatever. Whatever happened to Adnan Januzaj? And you think that Roy Hodgson was there, any number of people basically begging him to come and play.
He believed the headlines, didn't he?
Yeah, well, the whole thing, and his father helped him believe the headlines, and the you know, that thing. And you're saying, this is a boy who's been at two or three places where he has been given a platform to deliver, and he's just not delivered. Now, I'm not saying he has no talent. The question was, who failed to fulfil? That's the one I'd nominate from recent.
You need hunger to, as married with the talent to stay at the top. It is actually quite easy for gifted players. I had a few handful of games. I had good games for Arsenal. I couldn't quite stay there. It takes a certain mentality, I think, to stick around.
What did you lack then?
I don't know. I was probably too complacent. I was maybe overconfident in a way. I wasn't probably enough of I wasn't critical enough of myself. I should have pushed myself harder. And I think a lot of talented players are of that mindset. They rely on their gifts, and that is never, ever enough. Really isn't.
Leads into a question from Nick from Manchester. What are the criteria to be a world-class player, and does the Premier League have any genuine world-class players?
To answer the second part of the question first, I would say if you look at proven over the last few, because I don't think you can just say somebody's having a great season. For me, the proven world-class player, and it is probably one, is Sergio Aguero, is the Premier League's best world-class player, does that job, whatever, done it in a number of places. I think he is top quality.
David De Gea.
Yeah, well, okay, goalie. But the other one I was just going to say is in.
Only goalie.
I'm saying Aguero. Well, yeah, you can have De Gea. But we're thinking about the one, you know, the match winning ones at that end. David De Silva's an outstanding player and has been a great player. But I'm saying he's a great player, Silva. Aguero, for me, is top world class quality.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say if you're the top two or three in your position in the world, then that's good enough to be world class. Maybe if you were picking a squad of 25 players, would they make that squad? I think Harry Kane has got to be very close. In terms of centre forwards, who's better than Harry Kane out there, really? You might have said Lewandowski, you know, a couple of years ago, Suarez. No one's better than Kane as a centre forward at the moment.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about him later. Roger White talks about his Tottenham teammate. Why does Christian Eriksen appear to go under the radar?
Good question. Probably because he's not playing international football for a team that we're going, they are going to be in the semis or a World Cup final. I don't think that's helped him. And he's not been at a Tottenham team that have been winning leagues, etc. But in terms of creativity, what he's got, the standard he's got, he is an outstanding player.
If he scored more goals, he'd get more headlines. He's a great team player, integral to Spurs, but probably doesn't score quite enough to get people talking.
Just on Eriksen, I'll give you another, the opposite of this was, I remember talking to Alan Ball once, God rest his soul, and Ball, he said, do you know who's been the most valuable player in the whatever it was at that point, top flight of English football, and we're debating this, who it was, goal scorer or something. And he went, Matthew Letizia. He said, you look at Southampton stats on Southampton being a top-flight club, how many goals every season he delivered, how many free kicks caught, whatever he took, Letizia was fundamental to Southampton staying there. Now, because Letizia didn't go and play as a regular for England or play in a team that was winning in Europe, nobody now thinks of him as a great player. And that's the danger with Christian Eriksen. The platform you get, if he rocked up at a Barcelona or Real Madrid, somebody will be like, gosh, what a player. He's even better than we realised at Tottenham.
That's your
problem.
He's top class.
He's a good lad.
A couple of Everton fans, Rob and Stephen Smith, have asked about Steve Walsh and Koeman. I think we've probably covered that. Frank Osborne This is a question probably dear to your heart, eh?
Okay, all right. Uh-oh.
Should Theo Walcott move on from Arsenal?
I think it's a personal decision. It depends how what he wants to get out of his career. If it's as many appearances as possible, then he should leave because he's going to be in and out of the Arsenal team probably for as long as he's there now. I think from Arsenal's perspective, he's a player that's well worth keeping because he's not always outstanding. He can sometimes disappear. But look, you look at his goal count every single year, 18 last year. I think he's only played a few games this year. He's got 4 or 5 already. He's a valuable member of the squad. So, and he seems quite content. That's all I will say. So I don't see him in a hurry to leave. But a lot of players in his position would have left by now because they want to be the main man. I think Theo's happy to be there.
Do you think he's fulfilled, though, what Arsenal expected of him when he was there? And
I do. I think he's overachieved because I don't think he's ever been a brilliant player. Not a brilliant all-round footballer. He's magic at what he does. Driving in between full-backs and centre-halves to finish. That's what he does, isn't it? That is Theo Walcott. He's brilliant at it. But the rest of his game has been quite average down the year. So I think he's punched above his weight, actually.
Just want to end, we are in International Week, with a story, really, of two great England players. Sir Bobby Charlton, the England players are going to make their own tribute to him this week, and Harry Kane. Now, I know I've said great, and some would say he's not been proven to be so yet. But when you look at his scoring rate, you think he is something special. Yeah. Those players, are they quite similar in character? Are they hero material?
Well, I think, not material in Bobby Charlton's case because he delivered it. You know, he was there. I mean, I've been doing some research. I've obviously spoken to Bobby a few times down the years and had a memorable trip to Mali when England, I recall, were trying to get the 2006 World Cup, and before
that went well, didn't it?
Well, before we realised how corrupt it all was, and the Malians, FN Minister of Sport, I think, was one of the people who was a major beneficiary of SEP's largesse. But the point being, I got invited on this trip to witness, and Bobby was the ambassador who was with him. Bobby Charlton was 63 then. Bobby went out and did coaching clinics with young kids in the capital city, Bamako. At 63, you would not believe the ability Bobby had to strike balls and literally his two-footedness. And he was explaining to these kids and showing them drills about how they had to be two-footed and decide where they were going to beat the keeper and where they were going to put the ball. And basically, they could shout out where he was meant to be finishing. And this guy, quite elderly at the time, who they'd never seen play, who was obviously this legend of the past, he delivered this 20-minute masterclass showing them these things. And you could see these kids just astonished by it. Now, when you then look at his career from surviving Munich and what Munich must have done to him, which he has admitted since in his own autobiography about not a day going by without him recalling the teammates, especially two of his closest mates, he lost that day. You remember how quickly, and these are in the days before we're dealing with the traumatic stress syndrome that we're well aware of. A matter of 6-8 weeks later, he's back on a football field and inspires Manchester United, who've lost this game, to reach the FA Cup final. And he was a young guy of about 21 at the time, 20, 21. Now, you look at that as well as his career as a European Footballer of the Year, England World Cup, the best player we had in the 66 team as the great player. I think Bobby, in my lifetime, is undoubtedly England's greatest footballer. That's a great challenge for Harry Kane to meet, but his roots in terms of respecting his club and being there as a man who appreciates what's for him, what's been done in the past of that club, he's got a good start to it.
Yeah,
it's a good role model, I think, Harry.
Yeah, because, you know, Sir Bobby, the one thing that strikes you when you meet him is his natural humility.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I see that in Harry Kane as well, don't you?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think he's a rare breed, isn't he, in terms of, I don't think he would always put himself first. He's a club man. I can see him staying at Spurs for his whole career. I really, really hope he does, actually. It's so unusual these days. And he's a great role model. Off the pitch, you never hear of Harry Kane doing anything wrong. Family man. On the pitch, he just does the basics brilliantly, doesn't he? He's a quality all-round player. In my opinion, he has to be England captain. I don't know what Gareth Southgate's waiting for. He's the leader. This is not a great period for England in terms of the quality of the team. We've got a player that's different class up front. Make him the captain. Let him be the guy that walks the team out. Let him be the poster boy of English football, because he's that good.
I agree with Adrian. Harry Kane, he's one of our own, you know. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.